They'd scored 3 or 4 goals before Fulham came to town for the whole season, and then scored 4 in one game.
Playing a completely different style to what he was doing at Liverpool. And this is the one thing I've never really understood about some of the decisions made at the, you know, at the top end in clubs, because it's like, you spent all this money on scouting and assessing players, this and that, and all these agents involved, but it's just like, it's just common sense that he was never going to do well.
Like, I always used to have this kind of argument with Akin, who also used to be on the pod, that like, whether or not Kante has the technical ability to be a top class central midfielder in terms of like going forward. And I think you're seeing now that he's a good player, but he doesn't have that, the ability to be that central midfielder that can like take that next step and say, you're like a Modric type central midfielder.
Give me the ball, I can make.
Yeah.
Hello and welcome to this week's Football Fans Podcast, the podcast that gives real football fans a real voice on the sport that we love. My name is Jordan, your host. And this week on the pod, I am joined by United fan Josh. What are you saying?
I'm doing all right today.
You good?
Yeah, good. Good news, Martial signing a new contract.
Is that confirmed? So,
yeah. Well, it's coming out of French sources,
so
that he's out for it. So, yeah.
Okay, I'm a bit gutted about that. I'm hoping that Jose was going to scare him off, but doesn't seem it's going to happen. We've had him on the studio. We had him on the phone, a couple of times, but we finally got him in the studio. Our Fulham fan, Jack. What are you saying, Jack?
Yeah, not too bad, man. How are you?
I'm very well, mate. Cheers for coming on.
Oh, pleased to be here.
On the pod. We're going to talk about your mob later on. I'm sure you don't really want to talk about them, but I do.
we could avoid that. That'd be great. Yeah.
Don't worry, we'll get there. And we have also making his debut in the studio and on the pod, full stop, Chelsea fan Nye. What are you saying, man?
Hey, man, you good? Yeah, thanks for having me on. My YouTube channel's Blue Lions TV, in case anyone wants to...
He's gone straight in. Cheers for coming on the pod, man. Nice one, guys. Shout out to all of our listeners. I'm going to follow up Nye and big up all of our channels as well. We're on Facebook, Football Fans Podcast. We're on Instagram, Football Fans Podcast. And on Twitter, Football Fans Pod. So make sure you sign up and subscribe to all of our socials. Right. Let's do some drive-bys, gentlemen. Jack and Nye, it's your first time doing drive-bys. So, rules are very simple. I'll ask you a question which you're not prepared for. You have 1 minute to answer the question. And the only rules are you cannot be interrupted by anybody else on the panel. So, I'm going to start with you, Nye. Your first question is, of the 4 players I'm about to name, who for you is the best crosser of the ball? Okay? And I want to know why. Kevin De Bruyne, Marcus Alonso, Kieran Trippier, Robertson at Liverpool, or Valencia at United? No, I'm joking. Forget the last one. Of those 4, for you, who is the best cross of the ball?
I'm going to... Very simple one. It's between Trippier and De Bruyne for me. I'm going to go for Kevin De Bruyne. I think it's the versatility in the crosses, and he can cross from within the half spaces with accuracy. Low different crosses. How many times do you see him evade every single person inside the box? Plays them first time with the correct amount of pace that can just take people out of the game entirely. And I think that with De Bruyne, I think that that's for me, that's why I think he's the best crosser out of all of them.
Interesting you put Trippier above Alonso.
Yeah, I mean, Alonso's crossing is not that. It's,
you don't think?
It's not all that. I see him every week.
I thought he was quite good. I thought that was the one good thing he did.
I thought that was his one weapon. Getting inside the box and the shot every now and then, but. That's it with him.
Okay, interesting. Cool. Jack.
Yes.
Aaron Ramsey leaving Arsenal. It seems like it's on the cards for a free at some point, next summer. In your opinion, do you think this is just another example of bad business from Arsenal? Or do you think this is Emery stamping his authority on what he wants his squad going forward to be? And it's actually a good move to get rid of him.
Yeah, I think it's not the worst shout in the world getting rid of Ramsey. I think he's a good player, but I'm not sure he's... top level caliber in terms of title winning squads. You know, we just spoke about De Bruyne or Silva, and you look at those players and you can't put Aaron Ramsey into the same camp. He's a good player, but he's fine. And if Emery wants to put his mark on that squad, you look at the likes of Torreira that's come in and like revamp that entire squad, the likes of Xhaka playing next to him, who looks a different player with Lucas Torreira next to him than he did in all of those seasons, under Wenger, where we really didn't make any points on that in terms of getting inroads into that Arsenal team. So I think that getting rid of him and building an Emery squad that allows him to make the most out of players like Torreira and Xhaka is probably a good move going forward.
Good shout, nice one. Finally, Josh. Raheem Sterling, he has 18 months or around about that left on his contract. We're going to talk about Sterling in a bit more detail on next week's show, but factoring in his age, ability and the price that he would go for, which of these 2 attackers do you think makes more sense for Real Madrid to go for? Sterling or Hazard?
Oh, that's easy, Hazard.
Why?
100% Hazard.
Why?
Because, all right, let me just say this first. Sterling is a really good player.
Mm-hmm.
For City, he is probably one of their most important players, even though I don't think he's that great. But he scores a lot of goals, mm-hmm. he gets a lot of assists, and he's really important for City. They need to sign that contract. But Eden Hazard, you're talking about best player in the Premier League, probably could go on to be the best player in the world now that Ronaldo is
on the slide.
Mm-hmm. Messi maybe is going to retire at some point.
Mm-hmm.
You're looking like, who are the next players? You've got Griezmann, you've got Gareth Bale, who I don't really think should deserve to be there.
Mm-hmm.
Eden Hazard is that guy. I mean, I think he's the best player at the World Cup.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think you're talking about possibly the best player in the world. And if you want to sign a new player, you get that guy in.
But if I'm factoring in age as well, does mm-hmm. he make... He's 29, Hazard, now?
I think like 27.
27? Yeah. Okay, yeah. 29.
Hazard isn't... Even if Hazard was 29,
mm-hmm.
Sterling is good, but I don't think he is going to be, you know, best
player
in
the world.
Top five in the world. I don't think he's that level.
Okay.
And so if you've got... Between Sterling and a player like that, you've got to go for Hazard.
Yeah. Okay, let's stick on Hazard and Chelsea. Let's have our first chat, gentlemen. I want to talk about Chelsea. We have a Chelsea fan here. And I want to know, I will start with you, actually, Josh, on this one.
Oh.
I want to know if we think... What I find interesting is how quickly Chelsea have managed to... get their game under their new manager Sarri so mm-hmm. quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a thing obviously know about called Sarri Ball, mm-hmm. which he kind of made his name for at Napoli. And I want to know from you guys, starting with you, Josh, how they've managed to learn this Sarri Ball so quickly, if indeed you do think that what they're playing now is Sarri Ball.
Okay, so it's good that you caveated the question because I don't necessarily think they're playing Sarri Ball right now.
So first of all, explain what Sarri Ball is.
Well,
your interpretation of it anyway.
I just, it's difficult to explain. They play a very fast-paced attacking game.
Mm-hmm.
They're quite direct,
mm-hmm.
high pressing, but they also use the fullbacks really, really high up the pitch. And they usually play with a striker that is really involved in the development of the game. So when Higuain used to play for Napoli, he used to drop very, very deep and link up the play with Mertens and Insigne on the other side, and then just get in the box.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you don't see that with Chelsea at the moment because Morata just isn't... He's just not doing mm-hmm. his job.
Mm-hmm.
And they've put Giroud in there, and he's been okay, but they don't have all of the pieces right now,
mm-hmm.
especially in the midfield. One of the things that they did that was really important was signing Jorginho. Because if you look at the Chelsea midfield from last season... I don't think many of them could play. Even Kante, for instance, I don't
it's
think he's
game,
a sorry type of central midfielder.
Mm-hmm.
Even like if you watch what Kante is doing in the team this
mm-hmm.
season,
mm-hmm.
he's playing a lot more advanced, but he doesn't have... Like, I always used to have this kind of argument with Akin, who also used to be on the pod, that like whether or not Kante has the technical ability to be a top-class central midfielder in mm-hmm. terms of like going forward.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you're seeing now that he's a good player, but he doesn't have that the ability to be that central midfielder can like take that next step and mm-hmm. say you're like a Modric type central
give
midfielder.
Me the ball,
you've got
like,
give me the
happen.
Ball, I can make yeah. So I think like what Sarri has done and what I think is what good managers do is that they look at the squad and they keep it simple. I need to get my best players in the best position to be able to hurt the opposition.
Mm.
And so he's brought in a player who he trusts, who can run the central midfield. And then he's basically said, right, we're going to get Hazard up the pitch, we're going to get Willian up the pitch, and we're going to try and score goals. They're not the very best defensively at the moment. They're very, very bad. They haven't conceded that many goals. I saw a stat recently that said that I think City have conceded about five, have had five clear-cut chances to get them against them and conceded three goals from them. Liverpool 5 and conceded one goal, and Chelsea 17 and conceded one.
Okay.
So I think Chelsea at the moment they're good going forward because they've got a really, really good player in Hazard,
mm-hmm.
and they're not really great defensively, but they haven't really been punished. In
okay.
that sense.
Okay. So now you tell me. You go every week, most weeks.
Season ticket holder.
There you go. Yeah. So what are you seeing? And does the interpretation of what of what have how Josh sees Sarri ball. Is that what you're seeing? And if not, what are you seeing just under this new manager at Chelsea?
I mean, I definitely agree with some of the sentiment. I feel that, you know, we have the foundations now for Sarri ball. I think Jorginho was the most important signing. And yeah, it's not because of his great passing. And, you know, Sarri himself has said that, you know, probably Cesc Fabregas is a better passer than Jorginho. But with Jorginho, he's basically like the voice of the coach on the pitch. So, for example, when we start pressing high and aggressively, that's always Jorginho.
He's the trigger.
He gets up there. He tells the team when to press, when to come back. He dictates everything, not just with his feet and his passing, but vocally as well. And I think, to be honest, I've been telling everyone on my channel, I kind of expected us to pick things up really quickly. I think, number one, whenever you implement a tactical style that complements the players you already have, it's going to be even easier. I think having Conte as well, I think he kind of helped at times in terms of that defensive structure. You know, Sarri likes his back four. Yeah, obviously, playing the offside trap, he needs to keep in line all the time. And I think because, you know, playing under someone like Conte, very rigid, very strong tactically when it comes to spending so much time in the training ground, as working on defending off the ball. You know, he used to have this thing called like the shadow training style. So it was like they just play without the ball in training, just focusing on where to be off the ball. And I think this is why they were able to pick it up quite quickly. I think, of course, that stat about clear-cut chances created against us, I think that's understandable, of course. You know, we're still getting used to this high-pressing style. I think during the first few games, that's when it came. But I think recently, haven't been creating too many chances from, you know, I mean, opposition haven't been getting too many clear-cut opportunities. But I think 100% the foundations are there. I see the play as well. I think, of course, you're correct. We still need a striker. I think that obviously in a Sarri system, he likes the poachers. But, you know, I think I looked at stats of Higuain and Mertens. I think they only average between like 22 to 28 passes a game. So really, of course, with the build-up and...
What, because they spend all their time in the box just getting tap-ins?
That too, but also the movement stretching, you know, like runs off the... But yeah, you're kind of right.
No, that wasn't a shot. Right. I was just thinking, sorry.
No, you're right. Because, I mean, Napoli, most of the goals they score are from open play. Okay. A lot of times it was just like that typical like Guardiola, you know, passing the box, tapping inside.
So let me ask you, in the big games... Have Chelsea played well? So you played Arsenal, Liverpool, and United. You've not played anybody else on the top six.
No, they're the main ones.
In those three games, have you played well?
I definitely think that we have. I think United gave us a lot of questions. I think that we did kind of play into their tactical plan. You know, with United, with how Mourinho likes his team to defend off the ball, it's about being compact in the middle and then trying to force your opponents out wide to put crosses in and stuff. But I think maybe United weren't. We're a bit taken by surprise in terms of how good we were aerially when it came to attacking them. And I think with them just constantly giving away fouls, I think that overly aggressive approach from them kind of cost them in the end. But I think against Liverpool, because you've got to understand these teams have been working under their managers. It's like their third season now with them. And I think that with how like that, I mean, the Liverpool game was really fascinating tactically in terms of when teams, they were pressing, we were pressing, defending off the ball and that. I think Arsenal too. I think that we dominated the game, even though we had that 50-minute spell where Arsenal were able to create chances. But that was around that time, and we're still trying to get used to things and really try to develop.
I mean, the first half you were dominated.
Yeah,
the first half you were. I think the first half, I was surprised how well Arsenal in that first half.
But that's the thing, though, because obviously, you know, with what I got, you know, I'm kind of geeky. You know, I like to watch these games again, and I've watched it like three times that game. So it was really only like a 50-minute spell when after we got the first goal. They came back in. But then second half, we were in control again.
I agree. Jack, Morata.
Yeah.
So I was watching Morata on Saturday, and I think I came to the conclusion, probably harshly so, but he's not about this top level life. He's not about this top club life. And it kind of, I was watching him play, Jack, and it's the basics. It's the amount of times that he's back to goal, he's shocking. He's so poor. But his touch, is Morata a top-level striker?
Not anymore.
Or is just a guy that is just struggling with confidence?
Yeah, I think it's a bit of both. I think you can be a top-level striker, lose that confidence, and then not be a top-level striker anymore. I don't think he's a bad player. I think that when he came in, he was probably destined for that top-level run. Something's happened, whatever's gone wrong.
But was he, though? Because if Juventus and Real are both letting you go... That says something.
They kind of had
true, but they didn't fight to get him back.
I think they said they couldn't afford him. The truth of the matter. But they, you know, I don't know how that pays into them getting Ronaldo. You know, it works. I feel sorry for him. Like, I do think he had the ability to begin with. I think there's confidence in his shot, and he's not gonna get it back at Chelsea. That mojo ain't coming back. He'll find it somewhere else. I guarantee you. He'll go next season when Andre Silva signs for Barcelona. He'll go to Sevilla, and I guarantee he'll score 30 goals.
But that's my point. Is he a tier two striker? Is he just not in that top bracket of strikers?
Maybe not anymore. I thought that he did have the capability, but he is actually still quite young. He's not, you know, over the hill by any stretch. And if he finds that confidence and that ruthless streak again, then maybe, you never know. You know, see players have bad seasons and bad spells at clubs. Look at Falcao.
Yeah.
You know, Falcao came to England, couldn't cut at United, couldn't cut at Chelsea, went back to...
But at least before that, he had a pedigree, a body of work. Do you know what I mean? At one point, he was one of the top three nines in Europe.
Yeah,
so he had a bad period when he was in England, granted, but he had something. Whereas Morata's not coming into this poor period with credit in the bank. Do you know what I mean?
No, I agree. He's also not a Sarri striker. That's the truth of the matter is that, you know, to go back to the original point on that, there are elements of this Chelsea side that look like a Sarri system. Mm. There are plenty that don't. So the bits that look like a Sarri system is that the kind of Goulam, Heisage, full-back tandem at Napoli. He's as used to tuck in and play as almost a third centre-back, which is what Azpilicueta will do. Mm. And Marcus Alonso has given that freedom to bomb forward, which is exactly what Goulam did. And Jorginho plays the pivot. There was one-touch passes that drive the beam up the pitch in a quick manner. That's it, though. That's all that looks like a Sarri system in a lot of ways. You look at the goals that they scored, a lot of them were through the middle. Mertens running onto those balls from midfield. And Marek Hamšík playing those balls through the middle. Mm. Insigne and Callejon were kind of bit part players in that system. They were used to create distractions in order to bring other people in. And those players right now are Pedro and Hazard, who are the two most important cogs in the Chelsea system going forward. So for it to look a bit like that kind of Sarri ball, we need, one, goals from the middle, because Hamšík scored a lot of goals for Sarri, a lot of goals, and there are no goals in that Chelsea middle three if it's Kante, Kovacic and Jorginho. Yeah, they just don't score goals.
Kante basically gets into the positions, but he just doesn't. He's not the finisher.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, you know, you look at them and you think, you know, and that's why I think that Ross Barkley will get that final spot at some point this season.
Because he offers goals.
More of an attacking threat than the rest of them. And I think that once that comes into space and they get a striker, I think Chelsea will sign someone interesting in January. I don't know who it's going to be yet.
In midfield or
up front. But okay. I don't think it's going to be someone you expect. I don't think it's going to be like a traditional nine.
Okay.
I think they will sign someone like a bit off the cuff to try and play.
You're talking
that
like
Mertens
you've got a name
role.
In mind.
No, I honestly don't. You know what I was really interested in is something that Lucas Piazon obviously has gone out on loan year and year again. Mm. And don't get me wrong, this isn't me saying that I think he's good enough to play that role. But when Sarri came into Napoli, Dries Mertens was looking to be offloaded. They were like, he's a winger that he's not that good. He's not as good as Callejon and Insigne. And Sarri moulded him into that sort of poacher striker that he is now. And you know, he's one of the most feared forwards in Europe now in that central role. And I did wonder if the reason that he was keeping Piazon back was to try and do, because he hasn't let him go out on loan, was to try and do something similar, but he hasn't turned out that way.
Just on Morata as well, what's the fan base saying? Are you guys done with him, or do you still see he may come good? And is the reason you won't win the title this year simply because you don't have that striker that can put 15 Prem goals minimum in the back of the net?
No, I mean 100%. I think obviously with the fan base in regards to Morata, no one's really too happy. With Morata, he works hard. You see the application there, but it's the end product you're not seeing. A lot of times you'll do the hard thing, not doing the simple thing. I think it's just not press resistant, which is really getting on my nerves. I don't think he's really improved as a player. I'm thinking by now maybe you should be able to handle yourself a bit better. I mean, you've got a defender coming up really tight and aggressive. There was one thing Diego Costa used to do. If you do that, then he would win a free kick. He'd get fouled if he lost the ball. Mm-hmm. Right, just loses it and attacks break down. But again, I think our season's going to be similar to Mourinho when he first came back for the second time. You know, the 13-14 season where we were close, we were near the end, but then the fan base knew that with two, three more signings for next summer, we've got the league wrapped up. With Morata, you can't rely on him for any decisive moments. I think, you know, look at Martial. I mean, with United, I mean, their chances had come from individual mistakes from us. But then he had that ruthlessness, the confidence to finish it. And he just, Morata had a similar opportunity where he created it for himself in that game.
In the first minute of the second half.
Yeah, and hit that straight out of De Gea instead of bending it in the bottom left. Yeah. That's the difference. It was a very tight game. I don't think we can rely on him in that regards. But my opinions on Morata, the reason why I've never really been too stressed out about him is because, you know, obviously I've seen him play before. I knew he was never going to be a world-class player. I think the things that's always messed up his game is it's the mental part of the game. Confidence. He's too confidence-driven. If he doesn't have form behind him, he's not going to perform. And the world-class players don't just work on form alone, you know?
Yeah.
Josh, Ruben Loftus-Cheek, do you think it was... You know my thoughts on him staying at Chelsea. Do you think he's an idiot for staying, or do you understand why he decided to stay at Chelsea?
Okay, so... It's kind of a leading question.
Very much a leading question.
But I don't necessarily think he's an idiot, because I don't think he wanted to stay. I don't know what's gone on there, but it seems like he was really up for going to Crystal Palace, and it seems like Crystal Palace were really up for bringing him there, but it just didn't happen. And so I think that whatever's gone on there, I kind of put the blame on Chelsea a little bit, because I think that if they had no intention of using him, they should have just offloaded him.
Chelsea should have.
Yeah, they should have offloaded. Because clearly Crystal Palace wanted him. Yeah. Clearly he wanted to go there. Mm-hmm. So why
make it do what happened?
Can I provide some context?
Go on.
Honestly, I've heard a few things. Now, one club that really tried a big effort in the summer to get him was Schalke. Obviously, they let Goretzka go to Bayern Munich.
Yeah.
Ruben was interested, but then Chelsea stopped him from moving out on loan, obviously. Not the first time we've done it to him.
He blocked it.
Yeah, they stopped it, obviously, because it's like, here's the reality with Chelsea. If no replacement's going to come in time, then you're not allowed to go. Mm. But at the same time, you know, you were saying something about, you know, Ruben being an idiot. I don't know. I mean, I've always felt sometimes maybe he's a bit too nice, too passive. I think that the thing with him is he's a massive Chelsea fan. He really wants to make it at Chelsea. So many of them do. That's what they're thinking about all the time. But my thing's always been, Chelsea isn't the be-all and end-all. You got to like look out for your career. I mean, you're looking at Mason Mount, who's already played more minutes. Ruben's 3 years older. And I'm just like, it's not the first time Chelsea have stopped him leaving on loan. I remember a few seasons ago when Mourinho left, Stoke City wanted to sign him on loan. We blocked him from going, saying, oh, you're going to get opportunities, which he never got. They signed Mbula instead, who was just like awful for them. And I mean, with Ruben now, I think this could potentially be his final season. I think if he does leave on loan, then we'll probably be signing a replacement. But I mean, I could go on forever about how Chelsea use their youth, but
that's a whole different show.
We'll have him at Fulham. Honestly, we'll have him at the Cottage in January, and you can have him back 6 months later. He doesn't have to move else.
Even on loan, he needs to leave.
Come on, man, break out of that.
He needs to go.
Jack, we're going to run through a couple more points. Kante, do you think changing his role was worth crowbarring Jorginho into this team? Because you mentioned, and as did Josh, how integral Jorginho's role is in this Sarri team. But was it worth sacrificing Kante with what he was doing and arguably the best in the world at it to what he's doing now? Because it seems like you can't get, I don't know if you can get the two of them in the system that you want, doing what they both do best. Someone's got to sacrifice their role slightly, and it seems like Kante has been the one that's been asked to do a different role. Is it worth it?
I think he's the best destroyer in world football, but then again, you've probably got the best metronome in world football next to him, so it's depending on how you want it. Look, the way they could fit into the same system is Sarri changing to a 4-2-3-1, but that's not going to happen. So you've just got to accept that if you're bringing Kante into a box-to-box role, you're going to lose some of the elements of his game. And there was a point made, I listened to a podcast earlier, and someone said that it was the ball that went across to Martial for the second goal is the kind of ball that last year you'd expected Kante to pick out and intercept and take away from that. And the fact that he's not there,
he's so far up the pitch now,
is because of his changing role. And of course, you then lose that kind of element to his game. But, you know, he definitely has the engine to do box to box. You know, we've seen it before that he was more than just a sitting destroyer. He always did get about the pitch. He's just a little bit, I think, you know, something that you said earlier was that when Jorginho plays, he directs traffic, and you can see him pointing. Watch Jorginho just on his own for like 5 minutes next time Chelsea play, and he just directs everyone. He's constantly pointing, he's constantly like shoving people in directions. And I think that he puts Kante into situations sometimes where he's like, I need to be back there, and Jorginho's like, no, you don't.
I'm like, telling you where to go.
You listen to me now, pal. I mean, do I think it's worth it? I think it will be if Chelsea transform themselves fully into that Sarri ball system, and it does eventually kind of breed the football that you'd expect it to. But right now it feels a bit difficult for Kante.
And just final point, Kepa, I'm going to get his name right here, Arrizabalaga. There you go. Is he any good? Because I knew minimal about him before he came. Is he, you know, how good is he from what you've seen up top? Paid a lot of money for him. Is he good?
He's a fantastic keeper. Of course, we all know, like, last January Madrid were close and they pulled out the deal or something. But again, when I heard that we were close to signing him, I was trying to do some research, managed to see a few like Bilbao games on the internet. Obviously Bilbao, but I think a bit like a more of a physical team in La Liga. Because one thing I always thought with Kepa was maybe he might struggle in the physical sense from like aerial balls, defending set pieces. But then obviously he's already been used to that style of football playing for Bilbao, and I think watching the guy play, confidence supreme, head's always up all the time. He just has that, like, he reminds me of like and Petr Cech first time for us. Of course he replaced Kudelski, no one really knew much about him. He just kept doing this thing very quietly, confident. You could see he had the ability there. I think it's the same feeling I'm getting from Kepa. Good distribution, very acrobatic. I think this is why fans were like him more than Courtois. Courtois is not really that acrobatic or fun to watch, like a De Gea or something. But I think Kepa's got all the qualities. Very jumping in the air is very good. Gets down very quickly, can pass, and he gives that defence confidence, because it's like if they're under pressure. And there were times when Lukaku was inside the books and Rudiger would still pass it back to Kepa, because he knows Kepa's not going to mess up. So
we'll get the job done.
Yeah. You know what?
Go on.
On Kepa.
Go on, quickly.
Like, I have to eat some crow. Because I was really hoping, hoping he's gonna bomb, because like 72 million, and obviously, I was like, come on, like big crap. And then I think the Liverpool game, he made a mistake, didn't he?
It was
game?
Earlier than that. It was
the Arsenal game. It was the Arsenal game.
It wasn't like a massive mistake.
It was a goal that he conceded, and like he should have saved it. Like
a Wobi shot, innit?
And I was like, I was like, come on,
yeah. But even that is like, have saved it, but
it wasn't a blank.
Yeah, you expect Wobi to score from there, though.
I have to say, I think he's been the best keeper in the league this season.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, like if you to think about like
on the 10 games
all
so
round,
far.
Saves, distribution, commanding the area, like just looking confident, like and passing the ball back to him, like when you try to play out from the back, especially if you're just trying to implement Sarri ball, he's probably, along with Jorginho, he's probably been the most important signing.
Okay. Cool. Let's have a very brief fantasy football update. Gentlemen, Tom Robertson has slipped a second with a game week of 42 points this weekend, but he has Maddison playing in this evening's game as we record this. Martin Harris is top with 46 points this weekend, and he also has Maddison in his team this weekend. Jack, in our league, you're 20th. You had a game week of 38 points.
Yeah, I had a bad week.
It wasn't good. But you have Aubameyang as your captain playing tonight.
I do,
So you're hoping for a hat-trick to kind of
reinvigorate. Yeah, fingers crossed. It's been a bad week all round. I've got a fantasy draft team as well. They did terrible.
I don't know. Anybody had a good weekend this weekend? Everyone had a reasonably poor weekend. And Josh, you're 25th in our league. You're a game week of 31 points, but you have Vardy to play tonight.
Vardy and Maddison today.
You got Maddison as well?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Right, I'm hoping for a Vardy hat trick. Oi, oi.
Oh, yeah. Please no. Do you play fantasy football?
I've never really. I mean, I started and then I just, after the
you
first
you get
week,
bored.
Yeah, I forgot. And I look back 6 months later and it's just like, there's no point. At the bottom.
Yeah, there is. Cool. Well, yeah, we'll check in next week. In our league, the top six is relatively tight.
Where are you at, Jordan?
I think I was 15th last I checked. So I'm doing all right.
Slipping down the table, eh?
No. All right, 15th out of 81 teams, I think, is reasonably.
That's right, I'm coming for you. Just remember.
All right, mate, there's vodka in that drink there. I'm hoping for a better week next week because I had a really poor week. Who did well for me this week? I had Edison in goal and Aguero was my captain. That was
Pep keeps subbing him at 60 minutes, man.
Yeah, I was a bit pissed with that as well.
I left Van Dijk on the bench because it said he was going to be injured. Ooh. That was dumb.
And he got 8 points, didn't he? Okay, now let's get into some German chat with our regular German football expert, Rafa Honigstein. Rafa, how you doing, sir?
I'm very well. How are you?
Very good, my friend. Very good. You're in the room with Nini, who supports Chelsea, Jack, who supports Fulham, and Josh, who supports Manchester United. Let's start now with some rumblings that's been happening in Germany in regards to Bayern Munich. Karl-Heinz Rummenigge has been talking about the club being disrespected by the media. Raf, man, what you been doing? What's happened?
Oh, what's happened? You know, Bayern had gone four games without a win. They've gone two games in the Bundesliga with defeats. There was a bit of a crisis in the air, and the bosses have done what they sometimes do in these moments, which is kind of deflect attention a little bit. They've come out backing the team ostensibly, but really having a go at the media for a number of misdemeanors in their minds, inaccurate reporting, disrespectful reporting, attacking players personally. I mean, some of it you can kind of understand. The other stuff was really a little bit ridiculous. The problem that Bayern had, Rummenigge and Hoeneß, was that everything they talked about human dignity and the lack of respect, was all completely blown apart by themselves when Uli Hoeneß talked about Juan Bernat, Spanish left-back who's been sold to PSG, having had a, in quote, shit game against Sevilla, and explaining that that was the reason why it had to be sold. And everyone's going, did you just tell us that we shouldn't talk about players in that way? And one guy also, bless him, had the courage and the smarts to call them up on the words that they spoke about Ozil, certainly. Uli Hoeneß saying, well, you just said that Mesut Ozil has been playing crap over the last few years. What about that? And then Uli Hoeneß said, well, yeah, maybe I shouldn't have said crap. I should have said rubbish.
That's a big difference, isn't it?
That was the issue.
Yeah, when I get very emotional and I didn't mean it like that. Anyway, it was all a bit of a car crash. And the one thing you can say, the one saving grace, is that Bayern did actually win on Saturday. No one was really talking about the team and the coach, Niko Kovac, anymore. But I think that the Bayern bosses really didn't cover themselves in any glory whatsoever.
I want to get to Kovac in just a second, Raf. But what's happened at Bayern? Because when I've seen the Bayern teams recently, it does feel to me like an aging and very slow team and set of players. What for you is the reason why they're struggling so much?
I think there's a couple of reasons. I mean, first of all, I think they decided in the summer that Robin Legree would still be good enough to be given one more year. And then the young guys, their sort of successors in waiting, Serge Gnabry and Kingsley Coman, would be eased in. And between the four of them, you know, you'd have four people for two positions. And the problem was that Kingsley Coman got injured very early in the season. So now you always have at least one of Robin Leroy playing. And Serge Gnabry is good, but perhaps the wing positions are not his strength. I think he's better playing through the middle, but at least having a slightly freer role. So Bayern's game, which is very much based on the flanks, kind of suffers because the one-v-ones don't quite happen. It's not quite dynamic enough. And the transition that I think Bayern have been planning for next season, or even in January, where they've got this young Canadian kid, Alphonso Davies, coming in, now looks as if maybe they missed the boat a little bit and should have done it a bit earlier. I don't think the squad is that bad. I think you can kind of see Bayern's thinking. It should still be fine until January as far as the Bundesliga and Champions League is concerned. But I think it's also natural that people are asking questions and thinking that maybe Bayern should have been a bit more ruthless and let those older guys, inverted commas, go a bit earlier.
Niko Kovac is under mad pressure there, as you kind of alluded to. Do you think Bayern will and should pull the trigger? And there's rumours that if they did, there's a possible there's rumours that if they did do that, they would only accept a German-speaking replacement, and it happens to be a Frenchman who's living his best life right now, unemployed, who speaks very good German, looking for work. And I think I know, I hope you know who I'm referring to.
I do know who you're referring to. These two things are not connected, first of all. It's not about Wenger for Kovac, or Kovac still being given a chance until Wenger comes in. First of all, Bayern still haven't decided that Kovac is not up to the job. They still think that he can do it. They still believe that he is the right guy. Of course, he needs to have results. Of course, he needs to keep winning. More runs like the one he just had, the four games without a win, will not be tolerated. But we haven't reached that stage yet. So first of all, he's still in the job, and I don't see any changes in the immediate future. Wenger is not someone who's on Bayern's list. I think he's seen as someone who perhaps is not quite hungry and so suitable enough for the kind of job that Bayern needs, which should be a transition job, don't forget, for the reasons we just talked about. Mm-hmm. And Wenger himself, as you know, gave an interview in Sportbild where he said, "I'm coming back on the 1st of January." Mm-hmm. Now, if he's coming back on the 1st of January, there's either a coach somewhere in European football who's only there for 2 months to keep the seat warm. I don't actually think that's realistic. Or much more realistic is that he's going to come into an upstairs job as a sporting director at PSG, for example, or in a similar vein, in a similar club. I think that actually, considering where he is and the much better appearance, a much healthier look that he's had since not being on the pressure seat, would suit him much better. So I think we're very likely to see him in that kind of position.
Let's talk Germany now, Raf. What's happening, man? It's not looking good there. Is it a case of just, you know, Joachim Löw is failing to address small minor details that he's getting wrong? Or is there a need to identify, I don't know, the fundamental overhaul? Is it small errors that he's making and has made since the World Cup or even during the World Cup? Or is there something bigger and deeper that's required, more long-term required to fix in the current run of form they're on?
It's not easy to answer. I mean, the interesting thing with Tim is that he did most of the things that people had been asking of him much earlier. He actually did them against France. The result was poor, but the performance was very good. Germany looked as good as they have been all year. They had one good game apart from that against Spain in a friendly in March, where they really went head-to-head with a very good Spanish side. Now, they were very unlucky to lose the game in Paris. They did enough to win it. And they played in a very fluid 3-4-3 system with three fast guys up front. Thomas Müller was only on the bench. Kimmich was in midfield. You had new wide players in Schultz and Thilo Kehrer. So it was a much more dynamic, much more youthful team that defended well and attacked well. So the view now of Löw is really based on that last game, where you could say belatedly and far too late, he's made the decisions and has made the changes that people have been calling for. But because he has made them and because the team has responded quite well, he's basically alleviated the pressure on him. And now people are thinking, okay, it's a shame it took him so long. It's a shame he couldn't play the likes of Sané and Gnabry up front a bit earlier. But finally, he's got it. So we're not going to now get rid of him and start again, because, frankly, we can't really think of anyone who would necessarily be a better option. So he's done just enough, even though the results on paper look bad. He's done just enough to give everyone the confidence that he can actually oversee this new Germany evolving, which is already has the makings. He doesn't have to do actually that much, just has to continue that process which he started against France.
Is there any parallel, Raf, with, you know, Germany's biggest team, you know, not doing so well at the same time when the national team has had, you know, a really, really difficult, I don't know, 6 months?
Yeah, definitely. These two things usually go together. When Bayern do well, the national team do well, and vice versa. Bayern won the Champions League in 2013. A Germany team with half of the starters being Bayern players won the World Cup in 2014. The fact that you have individual players at Bayern struggling, had a spillover into Germany's team. Manuel Neuer has looked a little bit rusty. Müller is in a crisis at the moment. Hummels and Boateng not really their assured selves. So yes, these two things go together, but also the problems that Bayern had that we talked about earlier with Niko Kovac, struggling to find sort of solutions on the flank with pace and all these things. You could see Germany having exactly those issues at the World Cup. Unlike Bayern, though, you have the likes of Leroy Sané and Timo Werner and one or two others available, Julian Brandt, to actually alleviate that problem. So Lewis, I think, now at last has found the courage to be a bit more ruthless, to ditch one or two of the World Cup winners and to go with youth. It's a shame that he wasn't able to do it a bit earlier, because apart from the positive sort of tactical effect of that aside, I think it also sends a very important message in the dressing room that you will not play simply because you've done something amazing 4 years ago. You're playing because it's on merit. And I think that was another really important change, I think, in his mind, that now has made the German national team a lot more meritocratic and was another necessary step forward.
Raf, nice one. Cheers for that, mate. Cheers for your time.
Thank you.
Thanks, mate. Take care. So let's now go into our next talking point of the pod. I want to talk to you, gentlemen, about form and at what point, when a player's going through an extended bad period of bad form, at what point is it the self-responsibility comes into it, and at what point is it poor management of the manager of that particular player? I'll start with you, Jack, on this one. Where for you is the line of when a player's playing badly, it's the player's fault and he needs to look at himself, and when it's actually the manager who's... I've got some examples we'll get into in a little bit, but where's that line for you?
I suppose, for me, I think it's probably one of the things where it depends why they're out of form. I'll give you an example from last year. Fulham were playing terribly, and Stefan Johansson kept being asked to play up front. He's a centre midfielder. And he kept being asked to lead the line, and no one knows why, but Fulham went and lost to bottom club Sunderland, who hadn't won a game at home in 364 days.
Wow.
So we were there to, you know, make it the record, and of course we managed to break that record for them, so that was nice of us. Really kind. If you ever need points, you know where to come. But yeah, and for that, I can't blame Stefan Johansson for not being good up front, because he's a centre midfielder. Mm-hmm. And you know, you look at the likes of, I don't know, Morata, who we were talking about earlier, who is playing in his preferred position and the position he is, you know, ostensibly best at, and he still has no form. At that point, I think that's when the mantle of self-responsibility has to come into a bit. There's one thing, you know, if we look at, you know, Jose's United, for example, and you look at all of those players, like Scott McTominay been played at centre-half, and he gets pulled off at half-time, you're like, I can't blame Scott McTominay for having a bad game at centre-half, because he's not a centre-back.
But when it's over an extended period of time, so even a season, and you look at an individual and he's not had a good season, what for you is a point where you say he needs to fix up and he needs to do better, and do you decide he's actually not been helped by his manager by what he's been asked to do?
Well, it's probably completely situational. If someone who's out of form keeps getting thrown in at the deep end again and again and again and keeps failing, then you've got to say, hang on, that's got to be management. But, you know, if they're getting opportunities to do it themselves and they're getting all the support they can get, and you know, managers are keeping faith with them and all those kind of things, then you have to take on the responsibility yourself, right?
Josh, do you agree? I mean, the two examples of players that I've seen in the last couple of years, and in one player's case, 2 or 3 years, are Aaron Ramsey and Paul Pogba. Now, Aaron Ramsey at my club, Arsenal, it divides a lot of the fan base. Some just don't think he's good enough. Mm-hmm. I don't think he's been helped by Arsene Wenger by being played right wing, left wing, creative mid, defensive mid, all over the place. Okay. And it makes him look worse than he is. And Paul Pogba's another one. People say, oh, he's really, really good, but it's Jose failing him. Jose's the one that's playing him in the wrong position.
Okay.
What for you is that line?
Okay, so I think, like, fans like to make a lot of excuses for players.
Mm-hmm.
So with Pogba, there's always the excuse of, oh, he can't play in the midfield too, or he needs a free, or he's being asked to do too much defending. But whenever you really watch Pogba have a good game for United, his best games for United have been in the two,
mm-hmm.
not in the three-man midfield. He was at the World Cup. He did a lot of defending.
Mm-hmm.
He played really, really well.
Mm-hmm.
At Juventus, he did his defensive job really, really well. So So I think sometimes you have to look past. Sometimes you have to look past individual players. So the two examples you gave, Pogba and Ramsey, are playing in teams who are not performing well, right? So if you contrast that to Morata, who's playing in a team who is third in the league, unbeaten this season, that's the player, because he's in a setup that is doing well. And he's like the only person in the team, really. He's not the only person, but like with that kind of form, he's like the one person in that team who's not performing. If you look at Pogba situation, which person in the United 11 is really performing? Actually, Pogba's been the best player in this season. And if he's not playing well and his form is poor, then what is everyone else's form? Mm-hmm. Okay. So then you have to look at and say, well, then you have to look at the manager. If there's 11, if there's 7, even if there's 3 or 4 players in a team not performing, I will start looking at the manager. If it's 1 player, I'll start looking at the player.
Yeah. Do you agree? Do you think that it's basically, you have to look at the overall of how the team is playing, and then if it is, as Josh said, if it's one player in a team that's doing well, then it's just clearly you're the problem. Whereas if it's a team that's not playing well, and there's most of the team aren't playing well, then there's something wrong with the system.
I think it's a very good point. And I kind of agree with it as well, because it's like I've always felt personally everything comes down to the system and whether you complement that. And I think too often in the Premier League, I see a lot of clubs maybe signing players that don't really get the best out of them. Like, for example, the Aaron Ramsey point. You're right, Wenger's used them everywhere in midfield. But let's be serious, you know. I think the season that really got the best out of him was when, you know, Giroud was the target man and he was playing box to box, playing like similar to like Drogba, Lampard, that type of scenario. And it really gets you thinking, in football, how many players really get the luxury of, you know, playing in their exact same role in their system that really gets the best out of them, with players around them that support what he does as well? Very rarely happens. And I think this is why we call those guys like the world-class players, because they have like all the stars have aligned for them. But then the reality is in youth development and stuff, a lot of these guys that are top players now, they weren't necessarily the best in their academies during their age, but it's just how their football education, how lucky they've been able to get it. And I think that I think for me it's always system first, you know, because I think that you get the system first, you get the right players to complement that. And I think this is why when players struggle, it's because they're not really used the right way. I mean, you're looking at Sanchez now. Mourinho likes to use these guys
He's
as like
a good example, actually,
wingers instead of, you know, but Sanchez is all the best stuff he does is when he's playing more central.
So you think he's been failed by his manager?
Of course. But it comes down to the thing where it's like, why even sign him? You saw him have his best season playing up front, playing through the middle more. Look how often he loses the ball all the time. He's more of a forwards.
In that though, is there some responsibility that's got to fall on Alexis himself? Because you know, Alexis has done his best work, like you say, in, you know, that kind of free thinking attacking role where he doesn't really have to think about his defensive responsibilities. You know, in fact, he's better defending when he doesn't have to think about his responsibilities, because he just gets back naturally because he's got loads of energy. Whereas in a Mourinho system, the wingers, you know, Mourinho has always been a defensively reactive coach. That's how he is, and he's always prided himself on having wingers that work for the good of the team.
Get up and down.
Sanchez could have moved to City under Pep would have played in a system which literally is almost built for him. Like, it frees the wingers from all defensive responsibility. It allows them off the shackles. That's literally what Fernandinho's job is to do, is to allow those three up front to just basically do what they want. And in that, like, how much responsibility goes to Alexis? Because that was a terrible move. Like, it made no sense to join United ahead of City. It didn't make any sense at all.
It was money. But, I mean, you all know it was for the money.
Yeah. It seems to be. And another player I was thinking about as well was Torres at your club as well.
Yes.
I always kind of thought to myself that it didn't go well for him at Chelsea. But how much of that was just him just being crap, you know, and not being very good?
But this is the system not helping him. I mean, I always find it harsh to call, like, these guys crap or not good enough at times. Because, I mean, look at the reality of how Torres was performing. I mean, playing for Liverpool, you've got like Mascherano and Alonso like sitting really deep. A lot of the goals Torres was always scoring, it was like the last line, you know, like with the defence. Gerrard playing close to him, all that space to play in. That's the type of forward he is. You know, coming to Chelsea where, you know, we bring our midfield into the game and you've got to hold up the ball,
playing a completely different style to what he was doing at Liverpool. And this is the one thing I've never really understood about some of the decisions made at the, you know, at the top end in clubs, because it's like you spent all this money on scouting and assessing players, this and that, and all these agents involved, but it's just like, it's just common sense that he was never going to do well. And I think it's hard to say that he's crap, because it's like he's being forced to do something that he's never done his entire career.
So as football fans, do we have to kind of almost check ourselves sometimes when we are battering one of our own players and kind of like deep in the, hang on a minute, he's been really poor for 6 weeks, but then when you really think about it, take emotion out of it, are you able to then be like, but to be fair to him, he's not being helped by the system?
But at the end of the day, you get this type of situation where, like, fans can be very fickle, tribal, and they always need to blame. So you got to blame someone, right?
Yeah.
So your team's losing, someone's going to be the person who's going to be the scapegoat. So you get it at United quite a lot. A lot of fans, like, are divided on Paul Pogba, right? Even though he's probably been our best player this season, whenever we lose a game, like even the Chelsea game, and he made a mistake for the goal. If you see how a lot of United fans reacted to his mistake, it's like, you know, it's a very, very much a, there's a big, it's very, he's very polarizing as a player. Another player is Anthony Martial. He's another player who, I think, when the expectation on a player, like when you really want a player to do well, like when they end up polarizing fans, because if they're not performing well, there's a group of fans who are like, he's not performing well because, you know, he's not getting chances. There's a group of fans just that are like, he's not performing well, he's rubbish, put him on the bench. And I think it's really interesting when, like, you get, I almost find that in football, you always say, like, no player is bigger than the club. I almost find that actually managers are always bigger than football clubs when it comes to fans. I think you get the situation where you get a player versus manager situation with fans. You get a set of fans who don't like the manager or would say that the system is a problem and so defend the players. And then you get the opposite side. The fans who say no player is bigger than the football club, but they end up defending the manager over the football club. And I think it's really interesting to that dynamic.
You watched the Arsenal-Fulham game a couple of weeks back, and I'm sure some of you would have seen on Match of the Day, Cyrus Christie, who was playing right wing back for Fulham, that they got an absolute beating off Alan Shearer. And something that was interesting to me was that he'd obviously been told, he was playing right wing back, he'd obviously been told to man mark Nacho Monreal. And it left,
I mean, that in itself is quite
it was ludicrous. Absolutely, I'm completely with you, man.
I've heard Messi being, you know, man marked,
but it's told the wing backs to man mark the full backs opposed to, and what happened was it just left Iwobi with, like, you know, basically the entire pitch at Craven Cottage to do whatever he wanted. Thankfully it was Iwobi. but most of the time, like, so he just had acres of space. He was just like rolling around in space, and I was like, and people were going mad at Cyrus Christie, and I was going, well, he's doing what he's been told to do. Like, don't get me wrong, he had a bad game. It's not like, oh, he was really good and he had a bad game,
but he's been failed by his manager.
To do that role and told to man mark that player. If he's either ignoring the system or ignoring, or getting stick, so he can't win. Like, because if he ignores the manager, he's getting dropped.
Well, I think just final point on this one, guys. I always find it interesting the point that you made about clubs that will invest so much money in players and then play them out of position, and it's like, I just don't understand why would you spend 30, 40, 50, 60 million pounds on players, and if there's one player on the pit in your team who you want to make sure, okay, if we're all playing poorly, at least make sure he is playing well, and yet they still refuse to just acknowledge. I don't understand why.
What happens when you get, you know, let's be serious, we know clubs becoming more corporate like companies now. There's a lot of people, very great business acumen, doing, you know, as lawyers or working for this company, whatever they were doing before, but sports are a completely different thing. And it's like, how often do you see, like, a club where it's like you had one successful season, they're like, okay, we actually don't even have to spend that much money because we can just maybe do a few bits and pieces here, we'll expect the same results. But, you know, it's not a company, so you can't just, like, forecast everything as sport. Things change all the time depending on if someone's injured or this guy's available in the market, and all that type of stuff happens.
Well, look at Spurs this summer, look at the backlash Spurs got for not signing anyone. But actually they were fine, like, as in, maybe they could have done with a play or two. They were little deficiencies in that squad, but not massive ones. Mm. Nothing that you'd be like, oh, we're desperate for this player.
Yeah.
And they got so much abuse for it, and now they're doing fine, aren't they? Like, they're just ticking along nicely.
I think City also, in some ways, and Pep are the kind of example of a manager that everyone in that City team has a role and knows their role.
Yeah.
And they might lose games, but you can't ever say it's because that player has been asked to do something that he can't do. Do you know what I mean? Everyone.
Yeah. They do have it sometimes, but.
Oh, wow. So Arsenal are losing 1-0 now. I'm really upset now. We've just. Anyway.
Is it Ben Chilwell?
Let's just go home now. I'm just so pissed off now.
Do you know what? You know what really frustrates me?
Go on.
On this,
I know what frustrates
that point,
me.
That point that you just made, right, is that obviously there's a disconnect between sometimes what the manager wants and what the club signed, because you have this whole transfer committee stuff. But I think that sometimes managers, right, they maybe I'm just like really frustrated with Mourinho at the moment. But like, think about this with Lukaku, right? Lukaku is not the type of striker who can play with his back to goal.
Yeah,
but we always expect him to play that way. So sometimes I sit down and I think, like, Jose Mourinho, at what point does he, like, somebody, like, he
this
needs to be
working.
Called out on that. I mean, like,
You
know what Lukaku is good at. Why do you not play to his strengths? And I don't really understand how that happens in football. I don't understand how managers are so rigid in the way that they want to play, that they force players.
Is that because the person above Jose is not a football man? So Jose's response will be, what do you know about football? I've won 2 Champions Leagues. I've won X amount of leagues.
No, but
I know what Lukaku can do. You're just a businessman. You're a money man. You signed him, but I'm the football manager.
No, I get that. So I'm not even talking about, like, who signed him or whatever, like, blah, blah. I just mean, like,
in general, called out.
I don't understand how, after a season and a bit, right, that the penny hasn't dropped that this guy is not a target man. Like, I just don't understand how you can't see that he doesn't hold the ball up well, he doesn't link up the play well. And this is why I said about this, we were talking about Sarri ball earlier today. And I was saying that the best managers for me are the ones that put the best players in the positions to hurt the opposition. Like, Chelsea are not really playing Sarri ball. But Sarri's getting the best out of the players that he has. Like, he's getting the best out of Hazard, and that's what he wants to do. And I just find it interesting that some managers just don't do that.
So Mourinho used to be much more reactive. You look at, you know, that game we were talking about earlier when he came with Inter to Chelsea and he needed to win. And he played a front four that were like Milito, Eto, Pandev,
Schneider.
And they played all four of them together, like, for the maybe the first and only time that he was he put them all together, and they went 2-0. And that's what Mourinho was. He was like reactive. He reacted to the situation. And now, and someone has said before that this is because he didn't get the Barcelona job and decided to, like, reinvent himself as the anti-football manager, kind of. has become more and more reactive and more rigid in the way that he deals with his tactics. You know, he used to be a manager that reacted and dealt with it, and now he just...
It's my way
or the highway. Yeah. And I think it's interesting that he's developed that, because it's actually made him worse, I think, as a manager.
Agree. Okay, let's bring now in our expert. You are special as well, Ben. Spanish football expert, Ben. How you doing, sir?
I'm good, thanks, Jordan. How about you?
I'm good, mate. I'm good. Just join us once again. Let's rattle through a few talking points now, Ben. First of all, let's go back to the Spain-England game. What's been the reaction to that defeat for Spain? First of all, you know, towards the Spanish. But what's also been the reaction from the Spanish fans, press and public towards England? What's their view on this new young England side under Gareth Southgate?
Yeah, I think there was a little bit of surprise from a Spanish point of view. Obviously, they started off really, really well under Luis Enrique, beating England at home in the first game, and then emphatic victories over Croatia and Wales. And to go 3-0 down at home to England, you know, it was a real, real shock. For them, until they came back in the second half and, you know, could have maybe snatched something from the game in the end. I think they were impressed with England, disappointed obviously by themselves, by some of the defending and the way that they played after 3-6 positive results. But yeah, there's definitely a growing respect and admiration for England, and I think we saw that in the pre-match press conferences as well. with Luis Enrique, you know, praising Gareth Southgate and saying that, you know, he's a fan, he likes to listen to him talk, and it's a progressive young team. So yeah, I think it's a sign that other teams, even teams like Spain, who, you know, are probably the benchmark for England, let's face it, starting to respect England. So yeah, that's definitely interesting.
In terms of tactics during the game, has there been any talk as to trying to extrapolate what tactically went wrong on the day, or was it just a case of they just caught England on a really, really, well, for them, a bad day, and England would have beaten most teams, or, you know, and England would have been 3-0 up against most teams in that first half? Was there anything tactically wrong that has been discussed as to why they were 3-0 down at half time?
Well, I think there's some question marks about selection from the Spanish point of view. The defence was particularly shaky. I mean, they were exposed several times by England, well, three times, and you know, it could even have been more. I was at the game, England, every time they went forward, it looked like they could score, and you know, half time arrived probably at a good time for Spain. They were able to turn it around and come back a little bit. But I think, like I said, the selection, obviously Ramos didn't have a good game. He's their leader, he's their captain. That was disappointing. But Nacho, not a starter at Real Madrid. There's question marks over why. Maybe Marc Bartra didn't play. He's a Betis player. He would have been playing at his home stadium. You know, they're still looking to trying to replace Gerard Piqué, who was very, very important for them. And then the fullbacks as well. You know, it was, again, an experiment starting Johnny, who I didn't think was good enough. Probably is not good enough for Spain, in my opinion. And then on the other side, Marcos Alonso with, you know, Jordi Alba still snubbed by Luis Enrique, which seems like a more of a personal decision. You know, when you watch Barcelona play and you wonder why Luis Enrique is not calling up Jordi Alba, you know, he should be there. So, you know, I think there were mistakes in terms of team selection, and you know, Spain defend with a very high line. They were caught out by England. England did their homework and definitely caught them out. But Luis Enrique hinted at some changes in the next squad for the game against Croatia, with the group wide open again now. So let's see what happens when he announces his next list.
Let's go on to now Real Madrid, Ben. What's happening there now? Because it's not been a great start for Real Madrid. Lopetegui is having a bit of a mare in La Liga with Real. You know, I spoke to Raphael Honigstein, the German football expert, about whether a possible Frenchman who used to manage my club will be lined up for a possible Bayern job. Is there any talk about him being the guy that will replace Lopetegui should he be fired?
Well, it seems like Lopetegui's gone. He's done. When, we don't really know. I mean, there were strong rumours that it could even happen yesterday on Sunday. You know, after the game against Levante, they lost at the weekend. They scored in that game, but it was their first goal in 481 minutes. That's, wow, 8 hours of football. Jeez. For Real Madrid. It's a crazy stat. They've lost four of the last five games, and you know, he's gone. There's no way back from this now. The question is going to be when. I mean, I think the thinking was is that, you know, yesterday, Real Madrid were tempted to let him go, but because obviously they're playing in the Champions League on Tuesday night, they had the preparation today, the training session, the pre-match press conference, I think it was just a lack of time really to bring in anybody who could take over at such short notice. Wenger is an interesting one, but I've been told that Real Madrid don't want Wenger. They don't see him as enough of a winner for a job like this one.
Gosh.
I don't know. I don't know. Some of the other names who've been linked aren't exactly big winners either. So it remains to be seen. But I think it's a question of when and not if Lopetegui could go after tomorrow's game against Victoria Pilsen in the Champions League. He might go after the Clásico. It's just a question of, how soon. I suppose Florentino Perez can get in touch with someone he believes can take over.
Sorry, Ben, just quickly, what's gone wrong? What's, because, you know, the people that I spoke to were very divided on whether he was a decent, you know, a good manager in the first place. He got the Spain job, obviously he left that to go to Real. What's gone wrong? Is he just not good enough? Are the players not good enough? Is it just what's the reason as to why it hasn't gone well for him?
I think there's a lot of factors, Jordan. You know, first of all, you know, he wasn't by any means their first choice. Going back in the summer, you know, Florentino Perez didn't want Zidane to leave. Zidane surprised him with that decision, you know, after winning that third straight Champions League in May. And I really don't think that the Real Madrid were ready for it. And of course, they went after Pochettino, but he just signed a new contract. They got in touch with Allegri at Juventus, but he said no. A couple of other coaches as well. Joachim Löw, the Germany coach, ruled himself out. And, you know, they were going down the list. There was this idea that nobody says no to Real Madrid, but in actual fact,
everyone did.
Several coaches did. And, you know, Zidane hinted when he left, he came out and said, you know, I can't motivate this team anymore. And I think that probably set the alarm bells ringing in the heads of many other coaches. You know, is this a good time to take over at Real Madrid? And then, of course, there was uncertainty over the future of Ronaldo, who ended up leaving. It's an aging squad. Obviously, a lot of players currently tired after the World Cup. Players off form as well. And I think it was always going to be a transitional season, this one. Even if Zidane had stayed, even if Ronaldo had stayed, I think we saw the signs of it last year in La Liga. Real Madrid lost La Liga by 17 points. They came third. Mm. They were way off the pace. Yes, they won the Champions League, but they had a good dose of luck in the knockout stages of that competition. And I think, yeah, if you go back a year, the signs were definitely there that this was a team in decline. And
just briefly, Ben, you mentioned the Clásico coming up this weekend, I believe. There's a particular Argentinian player that will be missing on that game. What's happened there?
That's right. Messi only played for 15 minutes against Sevilla at the weekend, injured his elbow as he fell following a challenge with Franco Vasquez, fell awkwardly, and he was in a lot of pain, and they bandaged him up. They gave him treatment on the sidelines, but he couldn't continue. And he's out for 3 weeks. And you know, I mentioned he only played 15 minutes. That was enough time for him to set up the first goal and score the second for Barcelona. 15 minutes of Messi was pretty much enough to set the game on its way. It's a big blow for Barcelona with the Clásico coming up. A little bit of a boost for Real Madrid because, you know, with Messi playing, you really couldn't see this Real Madrid team going to Barcelona and getting a result the way that they've been playing. Perhaps now they can. It's certainly going to help them. 3 weeks out for Barcelona. He's going to miss the game against Inter, obviously, on Wednesday, and the return match in Milan. So, they're going to have to learn how to play without him in the Champions League. But it gives Real Madrid something of a chance at the weekend anyway.
I know as a Spurs fan, you'll be hoping he's still up for that Champions League clash with your mob as well. But hopefully he'll be back and firing for that game to knock you out of the Champions League. I'm sure he'll be back and firing by then. Let's hope so. Listen, Ben, cheers for your time, pal.
Take care, Jordan.
Cheers, mate. Nice one. Let's move on now, guys. Let's talk about Fulham.
Yo.
Can we not?
Let's have some fun with Fulham now. I will start with you, Jack. I want to ask this question. Are there promising performances despite the losses? Because I've watched a bit of Fulham and I've seen some entertaining performances, not necessarily good ones.
Yeah, for opposition fans.
And I kind of go back to the Leicester season. I think it was the year before they won the title, where they were losing lots of games, but they were playing well. They were actually playing really well. They were unlucky in a lot of games. And I'm wondering, is you see them more than we do, is that happening at Fulham? Are you losing games, but you've been a bit unlucky and there's promising performances there?
To begin with, we were. The Palace game, first game of the season, we weren't unlucky. We were naive.
Okay.
You know, we didn't do the things that we need to do, but we weren't. If we'd come away with a point or even three from that game, no one would have been like, that's ridiculous.
Okay.
And similarly, you know, we turned it up at Brighton and we threw it away, but those games we played well. We played much better. The last couple of weeks have got progressively worse, and I'm not quite sure what to make of that, really. Obviously, the thing is that you look at the first half of the Arsenal game, thought we were good. You know, yes, there were obvious glaring errors, like we spoke about Cyrus Christie and whatever, but ultimately, you know, Arsenal are a very good side this year, and I do think that they will that would challenge top four, and we were very much stroke for stroke in the first half. And then Lacazette scored a wonderful goal. Jokanović completely changed the system, and we fell apart. And you know, I don't think it's any real disgrace losing 5-1 to Arsenal. I think you'll steamroller a couple of teams this season, but that's not really the point. Mm-hmm. The point was that we were doing fine, and we changed it because we like reacted to a worldie of a goal. Mm-hmm. And in doing that, it's made us more viable to the counter, and we just went capitulated. But that's, you know, that's kind of much of a muchness. Saturday against Cardiff was just diabolical. Like, just, I don't know. It was almost as if who could be worse, and we won quite comprehensively.
I wanted to ask you, I was going to ask you before the Cardiff game, do you think that you will stay up by default by the fact that there's at least two teams, Cardiff being one of them, that look really, really poor? And then they go and beat you 4-2.
Yeah.
Are you genuinely now concerned that you could? It's early; it's only 9-10 games in. But if Cardiff are beating you 4-2, does that concern you going forward?
Yeah, of course it does. I think you'd have to be mad for that not to concern you going forward. Cardiff, you know, haven't scored. They'd scored 3 or 4 goals before Fulham came to town for the whole season, and then scored 4 in one game, which is
and you took the lead.
If you look back at the defending, I mean, I can't because I have nightmares, but if you go and look at the defending, it's Sunday League stuff at points. Yeah. And there's just the ball, like their second goal, the ball is pinging around from a free kick, and it sort of just falls behind the defence, and Bobby Reid goes, "All right, thanks, I love that,
thank you."
Yeah.
One of my things was, I thought Fulham would do well, hands up, this season. I thought they signed some really good players. Same. But I did make the point in pre-season that, like West Ham, I just think when you start signing 7, 8, 9 players in one hit, that's just too many players. I think they say that you shouldn't really sign more than 2 or 3 in one go.
Yeah.
Do you think that maybe they're suffering because there's so many new players coming, albeit good players individually, there's just too many?
I mean, yeah, I think that's definitely a good point to touch on. I mean, it reminds me of West Ham. You know, that season when they brought in Mascherano, Tevez and Gabadon and tons of guys, and there was a lot of disharmony behind the scenes because it's like, you know, forcing people together and then people feeling threatened about losing their place in the team and stuff like that. And it really wasn't a good dynamic that happened there. I mean, of course, you know, circumstances, you know, they got lucky. You know, they finally started to play Tevez and Mascherano, let's be serious, and they managed to get in there. But I think with Fulham, I think maybe they got a bit too excited. I don't know. I mean, again, some fantastic signings. I mean, Seri was one of the... I mean, I still don't understand how they were able to do that. I don't know how any big club allowed Seri to go that cheap to. For 20 million in the end, it was crazy.
Well, let me ask you, I was going to ask you just on that point. On Seri, A, what have you made of his performances from what you've seen so far? And I was always of the mindset that the reason why, because Arsenal were in for him heavily 18 months ago, I was of the mindset that there must be a reason why the big clubs haven't gone in for Seri.
Yeah.
Do you know, I've not seen him that much, but I don't know if you have, but are you seeing on the pitch now why an Arsenal, a Spurs, or a big European team didn't get him?
I think it's difficult to assess him too early, you know, 9 games into Premier League season. I think I watched a couple of games. I think I watched the Arsenal game. I thought he was all right. I thought he played well. I think he's done some good things and he's done some not so good things. So I think I don't know. There was rumours about him having some sort of medical condition.
He doesn't like the cold.
Yeah.
No, he doesn't like the cold. He gets chillblains. That's his thing.
Oh, is that what it is?
Oh, really? Yeah. I heard he had a heart problem.
No, I mean, it was definitely something to do with the cold.
It's the foot. It's not as if he's not playing in Russia, so he's fine.
Yeah. He'll probably be all right.
I think he'll be fine.
Is that real?
I think he's a quality player. I think they've got a lot of quality players. I think the one of the things that was mentioned is about bringing in too many players in at the same time. But actually, one of the things with Fulham, I think as well, is sometimes in a season you need to get off to a good start. I think that they played relatively okay against Palace. They lost. I think they beat Burnley, but they didn't. Even when they were playing well at the start of the season, they were just losing games or not managing to pick up. And I think the confidence then goes. And then if you've got 8 new players and then you've got players who came up together, promoted together, and they've got a connection, and you've got these bunch of new guys who've taken their spots in the team, you know, the dynamics is not going to be very good. And I think it's just whether Jokanović can turn the situation around. I really hope they don't sack him. because I think that he's shown he's a good manager. He's shown they can get them playing really good football.
Yeah. And as I remember, the first half of last year, you were shocking.
We were really bad.
And he turned it around after Christmas.
Yeah, he did.
Got promoted. So.
Yeah, yeah, he did. And there is that to be said for him. You know, and I don't think they will sack him, mostly because I don't think there's anyone you'd bring in. Mm-hmm. I don't know who the manager would be.
Bruce is.
No, we've not got enough right. We've not got enough right backs. Steve Bruce. He only comes into teams when there's 8 right backs, so he can play in every position.
Your keeper as well, we were talking before we started recording. Yeah. He's someone I have been watching a bit. He looks like a championship goalkeeper.
Yeah, no,
and is that an issue? When you come up, you need someone that can score you goals, someone that can stop goals. If you have a good keeper and a good striker, you've got a chance.
We've got the striker.
So on that, I said in an early pod, I'm not a fan of Mitrovic, and I had a bet with, it wasn't a bet, but I said to, I think it was Rance we had on one of the first shows of the season, that I don't think he would get more than 10 goals this season.
Yeah, I remember that.
Remember that one?
Yeah.
He's on like 5 or
something? Yeah, he's on 5.
So he's mugging me off, basically.
That's fine. I hope he keeps mugging you off.
He seems to be the only shining light in your team.
There's a couple of bits and bobs.
Yeah,
Sarri's shown glimpses. Okay. When he's been good, he's been really good.
Okay.
But he has also gone missing a bit. Mitrovic has been exactly what I expected of him, scoring the goals, the basic goals, headers, you know, the ones in front of goal he puts in the back of the net. We've got a fella we brought in from Atletico called Luciano Vietto, mm-hmm. Who's a lovely, lovely footballer. Mm-hmm. He's got sort of weirdly the most assists in the Premier League thus far.
Okay.
And that's kind of slid under the radar a little bit because like 2 of them have been like 5-yard passes that have led to like 30-yard rockets. So
you'll take them.
I'll take them all, mate. I'll take anything at this point. So there have been that. Look, we've also been a little bit unlucky with injuries. Tom Kenny is the man that pulls the strings for us.
Yeah, I like him.
And he's been injured for 8 of the 9 games. He's played once, and that was the Burnley game.
And you won.
Which we won 4-2.
Okay.
We lost Fosu Mensah early door. He's gone off with a broken, so he should be back. And we lost Joe Bryan, who was the left back brought in to make sure that Sessegnon could play further forward.
Yeah.
So we've had to end up throwing Sessegnon back at left back. It's all been a bit of a mess. Mm-hmm. So there is hope. It's not, you know, this isn't just a done deal and Fulham are rubbish. It just, there's a lot of issues that need to be cleaned up.
Yeah. Are we going to be back here in like, you know, late February and Fulham are comfortably 10th?
No. We're absolutely not going to be that.
You think this is going to be a struggle all season?
Yeah, I think we're not going to be the team that everyone was kind of hoping. We're not going to be Wolves, basically, which I think is what we were all hoping that Fulham were going to be.
Mm.
But I do think that it's not like over and done with. We've got a lot of talent in those ranks, and if it can come together, it just defensively we're awful. You know, Sergio Rico came in from Sevilla, on loan, and he's not playing because Bertinelli's playing between the sticks. That needs to change.
We need to sort out our back.
Well, we've got Sergio Rico.
Yeah. Oh yeah,
he can pass.
Wow.
That makes it even worse.
And we need to find. We've played 9 different back fours in the 9 games.
Oh well, yeah.
Well, on your defense, just finally, Callum Chambers, you've got from loan at my club.
We don't want to talk about.
I mean, I've been a defender of Callum Chambers. I've had lots of arguments with Arsenal fans. Man. I don't think he's any worldy, but I think he's a good Premier League defender. But it's not looking good for him.
It's not looking good. He's not. In fairness to him, he's been played out of position. He's been played in all sorts of different positions. He played CDM, I think, one game, which is really not ideal. mostly, I think he's been a little bit unfairly treated. But he's not been very good either. The sad truth of the matter is that he's probably not quite good enough.
Yeah,
definitely not quite good enough.
Yeah,
did you not bring up that point earlier downstairs?
Yeah, well, no, I'll concede. I'll take the L.
16 million too from Southampton.
We're the only ones taking the L.
And you'd have thought he would have tried to perform well at Fulham to kind of show the Arsenal.
I'm sure it's not his fault. I'm sure he's trying. Like, I just think he's a little bit.
And we've just equalised. Mesut Ozil 1-1. Get in there. Sorry. That's not very good.
Earning his 350 grand a week.
Yeah, with his once a month goal. On that note, gentlemen, thank you much for coming on the pod. Josh, thank you very much. Jack, first time, thanks for coming in the studio.
Thank you.
And I've been calling you Nine-Nine all day, but it's Nene, so apologies for getting your name wrong. But thank you very much for coming on the pod. One more plug for both of your podcasts.
I've got a YouTube channel called Blue Lines TV. It's a Chelsea channel. I do match reviews, analysis reports, transfer stuff, discussion pieces, anything and everything that you'd want. My fan channel.
with Fulhamish Pod. We're pretty much on all platforms just as Fulhamish, so you'll locate us, and it's all across YouTube, Instagram, Twitter, wherever you want, we're there.
Perfect. Go and check out both of those shows, people. Go and follow also our podcast. We're on once again Twitter, Football Fans Pod, and we are on Instagram and Facebook, Football Fans Podcast, and subscribe to us on YouTube, not YouTube, on iTunes even, Football Fans Podcast. Go and find us there. Until next week, peace.